the programme, A Country Girl in Her Splendour. Edna O'Brien at the Court Festival of Literature in Galway. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Town Hall Theatre in Galway and to this year's Court International Festival of Literature. Philip Roth put it better than I ever could have. Of Edna O'Brien's writing, he said, "Only Colette is her equal as a student of the ardours of an independent woman who is also on her own as a writer." And even without the curving letter U in his American version of ardour, all the strength, tenderness, and significance of that statement shine through. Tenderness and strength in abundance in Edna O'Brien's writing, and the significance of her literary achievement, her gift to us all, needs no elaboration here. She is quite simply one of our great writers, and one with an open and generous heart to other young writers who might hope to shape their own way through the labyrinth of words and life. Some of her rich, varied, and various experiences are recounted in her recently published memoir, Country Girl, a book which celebrates life, love, landscape, people, and the miraculous nature of being alive. It is with great pleasure that I introduce Edna O'Brien. It's almost a little surreal to be here, Edna, because years ago I used to look at your photograph, one of those famous portraits in Kenny's bookshop on Shop Street, close to here, sadly gone now. And I was thinking about that and thinking, I'm sure you walked these streets many times, Galway being a kind of capital of the West.
Well, yes. I was in a convent in Galway where I didn't walk the streets. I walked the grounds of the Convent of Mercy. As a young person and as an old person, I love Galway. I always thought of Galway when we were growing up. I thought of it as being, which it is, very, very alive. It's so vibrant, this city, in every sense. You hear music. You hear music nearby and you hear music far away. But Mrs. Kenny, the older Mrs. Kenny, mother of Des and his brothers, two tiny stories, because they're connected with Galway, I'll tell you about her. One was that she claims that as a young girl of 16 or 17, I came to Galway and I was taking the boat over to Arran because I worship J.M. Singh. And, you know, when you're young and trying to write, or even when you're not young and trying to write, you feel if you're in the habitation of a great writer, something might happen, some of the magic. It's wishful thinking. But I was going over to Arran. I went into Kenny's bookshop, either en route there or coming back. And there were photographs of many authors on the walls. And Mrs. Kenny claimed that I said, "I don't quite believe it," because I was a bit, not timid, but definitely. She said that I said, "I'll be there one day." So that was one little story. But the other was, we jump cut, and Mrs. Kenny was an extremely religious woman, and a lovely woman, but she was religious. So I wrote a novel, Down by the River, which was loosely triggered by the unfortunate and ex-case altered to the country and that. So it was a book that really didn't belong to the sodalities as such. And I come into Kenny's shop where Mrs. Kenny is now older and she's sitting behind a big thing like that, lectern. And I think, what is she going to say to me? And this is what she said. She came out, she put her arms around me and she said, "Well, if someone had to do it, it was better it was you." It's a wonderful. She let me off the hook. But I do love the city. There's a great heart in it still. And in the world at large, both in people and in cities, and indeed in landscape, there is less and less heart to be seen, to be found.
Those school days in the Convent of Mercy in Loughrea, were they happy days? You write about them with great precision and great affection in the memoir. I mean, it's even though we were talking about this beforehand, and you said in some ways this has been written about before, but to me it was, what you wrote was really fresh because it was also so honest.
Well, you have to lie a bit when you're writing. You can't put all the gloom in. But you also, if I were to tell you a story about a moment in the convent, or tell anyone here, it wouldn't or couldn't have the same luster as when you... And it's not that you're actually lying or distorting, but all writing that I admire and that I aspire to and sometimes fail must have this vitality. Otherwise, it's not writing. So you ask me, was it happy? Well, we were hungry a lot because, you know, bits of street lard and bread, and that wasn't exactly what you would love. And the cabbage. The cabbage is always, it's always the cliche of all institutions, from Charles Dickens backwards and onwards. There were moments of hilarity, which is different to happy. And what I think is so interesting in any situation in life, if you're living in a sort of repressed or a place of rules, a hilarity is almost physical. It bursts out of its own accord, and the hilarity could have been about anything. And then there was the fact that, you know, every girl was in love with some nun, and some nun was in love with some girls. Nothing happened, I'd like to say. But what was so interesting was a nun who might be very fond of one, I'd say, for the first two terms, then peculiarly and without reason took against one. So it was full of... And you notice I haven't mentioned learning in this, which I find... Other people go to university or college and they talk about what they learned, because I'm not sure that I learned that much. This is not an insult, it's just a fact. And I learned the principle of Archimedes in Irish. Nor a thumpthur dluhog I lach, sauleithur dhuun gogorin si marcan, agus I sonan an marcan sin, agus marcan a lach de dícara. That's... I love... Well, that won't help me. On a French railway station, if I say, how do I get to Lyon? So, but what I suppose I learned, I learned more about life than I did about letters or studies. I wanted to learn more than I knew I would ever be taught there. And that was about literature. There was a library, but, you know, it was Canon Sheehan, something of Tipperary, you know, not exactly Joycean.
Probably,
it was a sort of wholesome works.
Yes,
but
yes.
It was what it was, and it gave me, I hope, and to this day, a real discipline and being on time and, oh, a very old-fashioned word, conscience.
And a good word. A good concept indeed. Staying in Galway, a little detail that leaped out at me from the book. When you were, as you said yourself here, you know, when you were famous for having written the books, you encountered, I suppose, firsthand the disapproval of the powers that be in the form of Bishop Eamon Casey.
Yes.
When you were made to sit alone at a table.
Yes.
At a formal dinner.
Yes, it was the Country Girls had come out, so the little scandal and the so-called brown paper covers on all the copies of the Country Girls, the millions of copies, which I still haven't sold. I don't know, some arithmetic mistake. And I was invited by to Moran's on the Weir, I think it's called, Moran's on the Weir, to an oyster festival. And that went very well, and I tasted some oysters. But at the dinner, I was to be like at a table for eight people. Still happens in some ways, by the way. Can happen. I found a manager sent a younger person over and said, there's a problem. In short, I was put at a little table at the side to eat alone. And it was so hurtful. That kind of relegation, which can happen to anyone and can happen to me even to this day, not this evening, is something I take great exception to, because it's very, very wrong. It's a prejudice that should be kept. But again, nothing is lost for literature when I think of that. And a reader pointed out to me, and I don't have the American edition, I've given it to someone to give to my new friend, Ron Rash. A reader pointed out to me that, in fact, it was the bishop before Bishop Casey. He might have done it as well. But so I'm not sure which. But it just shows you that in that period and for a long time afterwards, and the irradiating power and knowledge and curiosity and vigilance and vigilante of the church was everywhere. Church and state and home, it was all one, which, as we know, has very little to do with religion or Christianity or throw whatever the word is, show the other cheek, or the tenets of Christ. It was about not the Ten Commandments, it was about control over people. And I grew up with that, as did many people here. What it does for one is to make one a little more cautious or reserved in kowtowing to what is called power. People in power, whether it's political or religious or celebrity, a lot of celebrities have great power, usually they abuse that power because ego takes over.
Drewsborough, the house you grew up in, haunts the book.
It does indeed.
The book is imbued with the spirit of that place. And there's a very beautiful photograph on the back cover of you silhouetted in the window.
Taken by Dorothy Cross.
By Dorothy Cross. Wonderful photograph. You are silhouetted in this ivy-bound window in the light of other days, in a sense. But tell me about that house, that place, and what it has meant to you.
Well, the house, I'd just like to tell you, as an aside, Dorothy Cross is a great artist, and she said she would oblige me and come to photograph it. And it was a winter's day. Everything was absolutely glistening with frost, and everything was sealed in ice and icicle. It was beautiful. And we drove along, and I said to her, you know, you will love it, because artists have they have a predilection to ruins, because ruins somehow carry. And I said, it's covered in ivy and saplings and this and that. And she's getting more and more excited. She had four cameras in the back seat. And we get to Drewsborough, where my nephew, whom I'm very, very fond of, Michael Blake, I told him I was coming, in our honour, had forked everything away that I had told Dorothy was going to make for Grit. I said, Michael, look what you have done. He said, I'll put it all back on. Drewsborough, both in my actual experience, my inner experience, and if you like, my inner mythology. Because everyone has their own little inner mythology about their own childhoods and so on. It was the biggest house around, or almost the biggest house. It was a Protestant house, small bit bigger. But it had glorious things like bay windows. It was built of sandstone. And because my mother and father had spent time in America and a bit of money was circulating in those days, you know, they built a biggish house. and it had tiled hall and a vestibule. I remember thinking the word vestibule. No other house around had a vestibule. They had parlours, but they didn't have a vestibule. So I loved it, and to this day can go into every room, the downstairs rooms, where one room where there was apples stored, and the smell of apples fermenting and cider, one room where there was a fire, and one room where the ornaments, my mother was a great one for ornaments, I have inherited some of it, there was ornaments galore, and they were beautiful. There were two plaster of Paris ladies that she called Iris and Gala, which she rouged and put a lipstick on. She also dusted them. And there were artificial flowers, which in my foolishness I thought were superior to the roses or dog roses or hawthorn on the fields. And it witnessed all the stories that I lived through and that had been lived there before me, before I was born. It had its excitements, and undoubtedly, it had its griefs. So I thought and think, even though I don't, it's not mine, and I don't go there anymore, I thought of it as being, if you like, along with my mother, the keeper of our lives. And I thought of it in some peculiar way, almost as animate. And I loved it, but I also knew there was much fear in it. And I think this might be the place where we agreed I would read one or two very short pieces, but I'm not going to stand up because this will collapse or I will collapse. This is almost the beginning of the memoir, and it's about Drewsborough. The two dreams could not be more contrasting. In one, I am walking up the avenue towards Drewsborough, the house I was born in. And it is a veritable temple. The gold light on the window panes rivering. The rooms flooded in a warm pink light for a feasting within. And along the paling wire, torches aflame, furling, unfurling. As I slide the hasp of the gate and walk towards the hall door, I see the line of men in livery, soldiers, the tips of their spears red hot through and through, as if they have just been pulled out of fire. These are hard men that bar the way. In the second dream, I am in the house, in the blue room where I was born. Doors and windows all locked, and even the space under the door where motes of dust used to sidle is sealed with some kind of wadding. The furniture is, as it was, a double wardrobe of walnut with matching dressing table and washstand. There is the slop bucket in green with a plaited basket button. I am there alone, incarcerated. All the others have died. I am there to answer for my crimes. It makes no difference that my interrogators are all dead. So my relationship with that house, and perhaps it would then extend to any house, or even perhaps without being too highfalutin', to the world itself, is a longing to return to it as if to paradise. And a completely contrasting fear of being in it, but there to answer for one's crimes. And in a sense, a memoir has some of that. It has other things as well. But I chose those two dreams as the sort of motif to then go into, you know, cups and saucers and the dresser and my grandmother's house and all the mystery and magic. in the house. For instance, in the one of the rooms called the dining room, there was never a dinner or any other meal eaten in it. A lot of chairs.
No dining.
A lot of chairs and a lot of furniture. But one of the pieces was a jam dish from the Eucharistic Congress in 1932. I was born in 1930, but this was in 1932, and it had a spoon, a hanging spoon, hanging from a from the, whatever you call it, a silver, you know, whatever, the top, like a bangle, but not a bangle at top. And I used to think, because religion had seeped into me, irreligion had seeped into me as well, but that we'll come to that.
It's good balance.
That the Pope's face was on the spoon, the Pope of that time. this may sound, what's the word, sacrilegious. It isn't, actually. It's rather innocent. But the licking of the spoon was tantamount to an indulgence, a plenary indulgence. There was never jam in that jam dish, it has to be said. The dish was of Vaseline glass. And I tell you it because I think I could write a sort of little parable, not a parable as much, I could write a page, or I could write a book totally about the objects in that house. But what it gave me, both in its supposed grandeur and in its contact with nature, nature was everywhere. I mean, the trees were just there by outside the window, and wind and rain and everything. And it fed me in a way that an upbringing in a city could not do.
Well, it all reads as having been so elemental, and in a sense too, with the house, it is almost an image of Ireland. All of the history, all of the conflicts, all life.
That's true, probably. Of course, they'll say we're conceited if we say that. But it is, in a sense, I suppose, of something with great glorious things and some shaming things and some hard things. I suppose maybe every house is a little minuscule of... I think what it mainly was for me was that its beauty was in contrast to its tensions.
Tensions between your parents, especially.
Yes, every family has tensions, and I was, I think, a very alert and over-alert child, everything seeping in. And you cannot, strangely enough, cannot write without tension. A happy family, sorry to strike a lugubrious note, but a happy family does not breed writers. How could it? Who would want to spend hours describing just the banister of a stairs or a bit of linoleum or a sky or a cow caught in the bit of barbed wire, a cow's udder, can't get in, can't get out, unless there's something abnormal about them.
The tensions between your parents. Throughout the book, there are various glimpses of your father, though your mother emerges much more clearly and strongly from the book. And we'll talk about her in a moment, because I'm fascinated by her presence in the book. But what kind of man was your father?
It would be very hard for me to answer fully, because I was very afraid of him. And if you're afraid of people, you don't see them in a rounded way. The father I saw was not the father that people were so fond of, that drank in the pub and bought drinks like Dan McGrew brought drinks for the house. So my father was, I would say, not born to be a farmer. He inherited money from priests in America who patented a medicine called Father John's medicine. I wish some of the royalties still filtered my way. And this was very, very successful. I think it was cod liver oil, but nobody ever said so. It was cod liver oil with a blessing. and it sold a lot. And the big house, my uncle, Uncle Paddy, had a beautiful house called Rhineski down in Loch Derrick, and Dada had Drewsborough, and he loved horses. He was more at home with horses. He was like even wild, whinnying horses. He was so, and he was so gentle with them. I found him fearful, but then I think to any child, even if we're not mentioning temper or drink or anything else, you know, a person who might raise his voice or shout is frightening. And in that sense, I could not write about him as deeply or as fully or as lovingly as I could about my mother. Towards the end of his life, when I was not as afraid of him, and he was alone and he was in a nursing home in County Clare with nons, and he had a very... He had an awful lot of time to reflect, a lot of time alone, and he made himself more alone. And the nuns used to say to me, you know, you must encourage him to go out. Not out, but to go out to the refectory, and he wouldn't, he didn't want to do it. And I wish, the way we all wish about omissions in our life, we wish two things. Well, we wish some of the things we did, we didn't do, but some of the things we didn't do. I suppose I wish I had talked to him more openly, what he felt, and what memories cropped up. He, unlike my mother, who gets much greater billing, never once mentioned accusingly my books to me. He didn't. I think he only mentioned one because he loved humor and told great stories. And the story he used to tell, because he liked to tell the same story again, most of us do. He was out in the field, and the cattle were sold and bought often in the field then, before the marts took off, right? And there's a man, I think, buying cattle from him, or maybe selling. Anyhow, it was a transaction. It involved money. And they were hemming and hawing and not agreeing. And the man, where he knew about it, man said to him, did your daughter write August is a Wicked Month? My father said, she did. Because that was also thought to be scandalous, God help us. And the man said to him, I bet you had a page out of that, meaning a few bob. And my father said, no, I had two. Now, if my mother had been asked that question, she would have balked, because my mother believed, perhaps with cause, that literature was a precursor of scandal and of sin. She had not read literature. She asked me to buy her one book in my grown-up life. And you know what that book was called? I couldn't find it, actually, but it seems it exists. Mother Knows Best. I don't think it was a work of Epicurean literature. My mother had a very deep effect on me. We were very close. We were so attached. We were very, very attached, almost as if that cord had never been cut. And I was the last child, and the child before me had died, so there was a reason for the attachment. But she was also a very remarkable woman. Even though she hated literature, she wrote letters of such fluency, of such actuality, going up a bit of mountain with a couple of cans to pick blackberries, to make jam for me. She was always holding on to me in many ways. And she would go up that mountain, she went up in one of her letters, and there were more blackberries than fitted in the thing. So she used her dress as an apron, and she put the blackberries in, but of course it stained the dress. But she would write me And she loved writing letters to me, and I didn't always love receiving them because in it there was the claim, come back, come back. But I know now I have them, you know, boxes and boxes of them. In it was also her own gift as a writer. In those days, and like Nora Barnacle and James Joyce's mother, there's very little letters. I mean, there's a few from Joyce's mother, and I don't know of any from Nora Barnacle, but Joyce mentions it. There was no commas, nothing. It was pure stream of consciousness, and it was pure creativity. It really was.
And pure poetry. Really.
No matter what it was about, it had... So she gave me that, and my father gave me a love for story. And in the writing of Country Girl, I swore I would never write it. I was so... I thought, well, I've used a lot of my life anyhow in fiction. What am I going to do? But I read or overheard things said about myself in which it would seem that I had been nothing short of Mata Hari, you know, that I'd had this wonderful life, these affairs, this adulteress, that I lived in clover. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm going to be dead before long. This is not the obituary I wish for. How would I have written all these books? I also thought, only I know my inner life. My inner life is more important than my outer life. But of course, they're there on the weighing scales. And I said this to my agent one day, and he said, well, he said, the only thing you can do is write your own. And I was coming home in a London taxi filled with temporary inspiration, very temporary. And I had happened to me in the week previous in that I had gone to a National Health hearing clinic because my hearing isn't so good. And I was tested by two or three people foreign. This is relevant to what's coming. And then a girl came in to put the little things in the ear. They seemed to me to be rather infinitesimal, to put it mildly.
It gets smaller and smaller,
yeah,
I think.
Small. Yeah. And she said, for your age, you are very good. But with regard to your hearing, you are broken piano. And I thought, to hell with it. I'm not yet the broken piano. So I never used the little, what I call the little ball bearings. And I came home, and I have a nice garden in a house that I rent in London. And the garden was at its most, there was a wind, and there were roses, and the petals had fallen around the clay bed. And everything was alive and sort of rampant with nature. I mean, city nature is not the same as walking along the sea here. So I began the memoir in a great surge of excitement and what I thought would be an easy run. But then as I had to dig and dig and excavate and not only remember but re-immerse, then the tears came. And then the, well, not blank spots totally, but I thought, I don't want to have to go there, but I have to go there. And one of the tasks that I, or whatever, the formula that I set myself, was to try and make each chapter almost like a little short story. Because I know you asked me earlier to maybe read a little bit. I think the man, you asked me about my father. I wish I had been in love with my father or loved him. I wasn't, and I would not be a hypocrite. But I did love our workman. And he was my, well, he was everything. I used to say, you know, we would marry. I mean, you know, I was 4 and he was probably 18. And will I read the little moment?
Carnero,
He was nicknamed Carnero for some reason, but that wasn't his real name. Our farmhand was nicknamed Carnero. He was roguish, lackadaisical, and disinclined to wash. He ate like a glutton. My mother had to carve the bacon or the chicken in the pantry, otherwise he would grab slices of it when her back was turned. He buttered his bread on both sides, muttering under his breath in defiance, "Let's larrup it on, let's larrup it on." He was about 80. On Saturday nights, in his pelt, when he washed in the rain barrel for Sunday Mass, he would sing some of his favourite songs. One was, "Oh, Miss Nicholas, don't be so ridiculous. I don't like it in the daytime. Nighttime's the right time. So, Miss Nicholas, don't be so ridiculous." He wasn't particularly religious. Very few of the men were. They would stand at the back of the chapel and nudge one another when the priest drank the wine from the chalice, whispering about him being a toper. By contrast, most of the women prayed fervently, their eyes raised to the whitewashed ceiling, the better for God to hear their pitiful supplications. Carnero went to the pub each night, or rather one of the several pubs, depending on the welcome. Remarkably, for a one-horse town, there were 27 public houses, 3 grocery shops, 1 drapery, 1 chemist, no cinema, and no library. And that was Carnero, who did everything. He ran the place, as he kept reminding me.
And there's a very poignant moment as well where he has planned to leave to go to work with his brother in London.
Yes.
And your mother is bereft, and you beg him to stay.
Yes, I came. He wasn't paid very much, which is unfortunate, but he had reached the point where he was going, and I came home from school and he was packing to leave. And my mother was, well, he did everything. He milked, he cut turf, he ploughed, he did. And, you know, we depended on him. And she knocked on the door, but he wouldn't admit us. And then she went away up to the yard to do something. And I did something terrible. I went into the room, and all his stuff, you know, off bits of bicycles, bits of machinery, old shoes that they were ready to be put into a flour sack. Some were already in a flour sack. And I got down on my knees and just, if you like, manacled him, imprisoned him by putting my hands and arms around his ankles. And I begged of him, just not even with speech, just with that action, not to leave us. And what he did, his answer was, it was very beautiful and in another way, very upsetting. He had one good suit, and the suit was on when I went in. He took the jacket off and he left it on his bed. And that meant he was going to come back into the kitchen and go up to the yard and do. And in the book, I say something to the effect, which actually is true. I said, I knew I had done something grievous to love, even though I did not know what love meant. But he forgave me, because he had great humor and great tenderness.
In writing about love, and you have written brilliantly on that mysterious subject, you quote in the book, you quote Joyce, "It will never be righted." And you also quote a nurse, Irena, from Eastern Europe, who looked after you in hospital and who said to you, "Please write book for men about love, because they do not understand it as women do."
Yes.
Of course, you have written those books. And you go on in your own book to observe that, of course, the great love stories tell of pain and of the separateness between men and women.
I think there is, even when there is a nearness, there is a separateness. Well, there are two different things about that. The great love stories, they wouldn't make good stories, you know, if they went, got married, had the honeymoon, everything's okay. I mean, that's not a story. unfortunately.
Yes.
Tristan and Isolde, you know, we have to get them, seas dividing them and all that. It's true in story and myth and opera especially, but in the great dramas as well, Romeo and Juliet. In terms of the separateness, I think regardless of the century we are in, and regardless of the incredible and marvelous change, and I hate the word to use, it's a cliche word, progress, but it's the only word I can think of at this moment. In terms of women's lives, they are not, or we are not, the chattels we were. Women, you had two women presidents in this country, and two wonderful women they were and are. So is the present. Let's not omit him. But despite all that, and the workplace where women not are equal but are edging towards being equal, and also women's voices are heard to some extent, a woman as an artist is still a tiny bit side. It doesn't get, for want of another word, shall we call it the billing the men get. That's the truth. It is wrong, it's short-sighted, but it is it. But those are, you know, everything is along the way. In terms of the separateness, in one of my stories in Saints and Sinners, somebody says, a woman is talking to another woman and says, why even when you're in love and it's working, you know, why is there always some fear or doubt, just something that it will not ripen to it? And the other person says, it's because always someone wants from the other person in love something more than the other person can give. Now, I do not say that men are not capable of love, as foolish, as mad, as great, as intemperate, as all the other words, as women, because they do. But I think in terms of the A, expressing that, and B, the length or duration of that. So the separateness has something psychological as well. It is no accident that a woman holds a child for 9 months. So biology does play a part in our feelings and in our minds. And I think a woman is more, it's not that she's capable of a greater love, but perhaps holds on to it in a way longer. And the separateness is also to do with what you dream at night, what I dream. A man and woman are lying beside each other. They don't dream the same dreams. They couldn't. Because as human beings, we're very complex. We're very divided in our lot of things, including our love. And one very important thing in terms of relationships, we change at different, you know, people don't change exactly. They meet, they're in love. They're very lucky to remain in love and to remain in friendship over long periods, because they will inevitably have had distances. They're unavoidable. So it's not just me. I used to be accused by some very rigid feminists, rather than true feminists, of just writing about women suffering in love. Of course women have suffered in love. They still suffer in love. So do men. The greatest book, I suppose, about women suffering has been written by Tolstoy, Anna Karenina. But I feel, maybe as a writer as well, and maybe the kind of childhood and experience I had, I suppose in life I do feel an outsider, not in any sense of being better or more educated I think if you devote your life to writing, and I have, for all my supposed tempestuous ways, you live alone, you think alone, and you write alone. And it is harder to manage that or to accommodate that within the framework of a normal. I used to say when I was younger, an ancient mariner is what I want, but not too ancient. But he would be at sea a lot.
A salty young ancient mariner. So in a sense too, I suppose for you, as an artist, as a writer, there is that pull of the need to write, to make that expression. And you talk about from childhood, reading and writing as the two intensities that have buttressed your whole life.
Yes.
And I think for me that goes to the core of you as an artist.
Yes. Well, I love reading, and I can't say I love writing, but if I couldn't do it, if I were in a gulag or somebody said you can't write, I could, it's inconceivable, I would go mad. What it is the power of a poem, or the power of a paragraph, or the power of a drama, or the power of a whole work, beautifully wrought and thought, seems to seep into every bit of me when I read it. And that is what literature does. It is not in the normal sense religious, it's secular, but it has the same effect as what religion has to mystics, to like St. Teresa, who had all those beautiful prayers that she composed to Christ. So from the youngest age, I was very lucky, despite the no library and despite very little access to literature, I got a taste of it. We had the Gospels, and I love the language of the Gospels. It's both so precise and so mysterious. And I got that then at a very young age, that this would be not just a ticket to leaving County Clare or to come to Dublin. And I'm very partial to the chapter on Dublin, because seeing street lights and clothes in the window, but that's another I don't know
and
what the time is.
And the cattle running down the North Circular. That's wonderful. That scene is so vivid. The cows, the cattle being brought to the ships,
march.
The cattle march,
the cattle
Because, of course,
march.
All of that is gone. And for me, so much of what you capture
in North Circular Road and the lonely sound reminded me. But, you see, that is part of writing, as well as, you know, honeysuckle or nectarine and peach or whatever those poets said. But what I can never find the words adequate enough to say that I think when we read something that both informs us, enriches us, and as Nabokov once said, enchants us, it lifts us from the life we are in. You know, I get really impatient when some people tell me they read 3 books a week, but they can't remember what they are because they're not real books or they're not really reading them. So that was and remained that I was given a gift, I think. I work at that ongoingly and frighteningly, because you never know when it's going to leave you. But I also would include reading is as important as writing. You can't write unless you read and reread. And one of the things that this evening and festivals and that makes me very optimistic about the state of literature is that there is still in people, in us, this hunger, and almost like this void, we want to be carried away, but not in a kind of stupid thing about reading about a footballer's wife's brassiers or something. We want to be carried away in that we are enriched. And that's what writing does. The actual thing of writing, unfortunately, isn't quite as glorious. I read every day before I sit down to write. And I read something that I know will fire me, that will make me want, rather like an athlete. If they see another athlete, let's say at a game, they think, yeah, I want to do that. And that is my training. Now, I often think what I also need, you know, in boxing ring, they have these managers and the poor boxer is on the floor. And he's told to get up, he's hit with the towel, up he gets. Well, as a writer, you have to be the manager. You have to do that as well yourself. And one of the things about it that perhaps is the loneliest of all is, let's say you write a paragraph or even a page that you know has pure life within it, pure life. There's no fake in it. There's no wrong word. It just works like a spell. You'd love to read it to someone, but you can't, because that would harm what you're doing next. So unlike the actor or the comedian or the singer, the writer has to have, in that sense, it is almost religious, has to have the detachment, or if has to have, you have to hold it, rather like a pregnancy, only longer than 9 months. You have to hold it and hold it until it's done. And then it's done, and strangely enough, I'm very, very glad to be talking to you about my memoir. But it is also like a little child going down a lane. It's also going, gone from me. And somebody told me a lovely story once about Samuel Beckett, whom I revere as a writer and whom I reread and learn from daily. He didn't like talking about his own work. It drove him, he had a fit. But one day an actor decided to memorize not a moment from the plays, but from one of the novels. He recited this to Mr. Beckett in Paris. Beckett said, "That's not so bad. Who wrote that?" So you live with it, and then you let it go. You have to let it go.
The last time we spoke together in public, it was about poetry and William Butler Yeats. Throughout this book, there's such a strong sense of poetry. There's also an incredibly strong sense of colour and the visual. And you mentioned Jack B. Yeats and how you came to love the curdled blues.
The curdled blues.
Of his work, and how they speak to you of Ireland just as much as any poem or any piece of prose.
They do. Those paintings of Jack Yeats, very often they're with horses, men with horses, or donkeys, a wonderful one of an ass. And very often they're travellers or horse dealers or all that. They have a very wild and primitive quality, which I love. And they remind me in writing more of Singh than actually of Yeats. And I like, after language, painting is the thing I respond to most. I love painting. But again, you can only see like two paintings at a time. And you mentioned the word a vision. I copied out once from some sutra or Eastern, perhaps religious book. And I have it in my little notebook, which each year when I change a diary each year, it says, hold on to the vision, for the vision will come. And that is what, in secret, each morning, you know, along with washing up the dishes and something is broken and answering the door, of keeping that faith with that. It requires both, I suppose, a foolishness and a dedication, but it also requires a faith. And that's why a lot of writers fear, and I would myself as well, the biggest fear for a writer is that she or he will stop. It won't come. And although the actual redoing and editing and selecting and everything comes with another part of your brain, the first impetus, the first thing, comes from a part of one that is a bit of a secret to oneself. The way our dreams come, you dream amazing things, you dream amazing things, you dream of countries where you've not been, desert, and you dream of, you know, a saucepan of boiling water that you throw over visitors in your house, as I have in this book. When I got tired of parties, I was told in my dream, Edna, no more parties. I went through an extravagant and wild period after I had left my husband, in which I had my supposed so-called freedom and a little bit of money. And I used to give all these parties, and people came from far and wide. It was like the Academy Awards every Saturday night. I don't know how I knew them, but they came. And that went on for a while, quite a good while, a year, year and a half, maybe 2 years. And then one night in a dream, my kitchen was the same kitchen. It was a house in Putney. But it looked a little bit more abnormal. There were red buttons, as in a hospital, perhaps, kitchen. There were signs of something that wasn't quite normal. And on the big stove, again, which was larger than the one I had, there were huge pans of boiling water and goose fat, very, very, very boiling, roiling goose fat, which I picked up and threw on all these wonderful people who up to then had been welcome guests. So when I awakened, I thought, I mean, that Yeats said he took it, he learned it in some ancient Chinese. He says, in dreams begin responsibilities. It has some truth. And I think in my own life, and if I were to be a teacher going around the provinces and the counties and the townlands, what I would preach is, don't let literature die. Don't let it die. It's too rich. You know, there's a lot of trivialization now of that, and there's a lot of noise in the world. There's nothing wrong with noise, but reading is something else. And we as a race are very noticeable for it. We as a race love language and love narrative and have a great long line of great poets and great writers who will be scolding and cursing us if we don't keep it going.
We will keep it going. So much more we could talk about, but we must finish. However, we do have some little time for a few questions, if anyone...
Yes.
What would your advice to memoirists be?
Oh, I like this question. What would be the advice to a person writing a memoir? Well, when I started this, the one thing I did say to myself is... because I'd read a lot of memoirs, and sometimes they go in a little bit, in fact, more than a little bit, for the self-pity. One can describe a very difficult and painful and traumatic situation, but not as a victim, but as someone, an observer of it, but who feels it, if you know what I mean. The other thing that I noticed in memoirs is a so-called happy ending. Everything is hunky-dory, catharsis. Love my mother, love my father, love everyone, because it's not true. I think it's a generalization, but to be true to every moment that you are retelling and not to shirk from it, to go into it, to be brave within it, but also to be on the side of life within it, rather than on the side of, as I said, the self-pity. And then to read great memoirs. Great, there are great ones.
Which ones would you recommend?
It's on the back of my book, a long
yes.
list.
Somebody here towards the back.
Brown, or if it's a common, but everybody knows of your devotion to Joyce, and it seems to me you are, of Irish writers, the most courageous, and I wonder sometimes in your books if that notion in Joyce about the consciousness of a nation and moral paralysis, as it seems to me you write a lot about in Irish life, if that has been a constant sort of theme or background to your feelings about your writing about Ireland.
I think I always remember a letter. He was going to elope with Nora Barnacle from Galway, Lons Island, and he wrote to Lady Gregory to borrow a fiver. You could do a lot with a fiver in those days, or maybe it was a tenner, and she declined. She was very generous in other ways, but not to Joyce. And he wrote back to her, and he said, "I know no one with a faith like mine. I will do it." So he had, from the cradle, a most formidable self-belief. Now, I can't pretend when I sit down to write that any of that crops up in my mind. But what I do know is that he was a samurai. He was a man who went to the war front in writing every day. And as he once said, he went to the Far Azores, but he came back. In terms of "I will go forth to forge the constants of my race, silence, exile, and cunning," which Flann O'Brien called silence, exile, and punning, as you know. I think he got a little too lofty there, to tell you the truth. But he was a young man when he said that, portrait of an artist. But I think no Irish writer, including the living or the dead, that came after Joyce, the ones who will be at this festival, who've already been at this festival, and the other festivals around the country, no one could say that they do not but owe a debt to James Joyce, and we do. And I think we'll finish, so because he was very superstitious, and I want to keep in his good books. Yes. Thank you very, very much.
And there we concluded a remarkable and moving evening. Our thanks to all at court and at the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, and most especially to the marvellous Edna O'Brien. Country Girl, a Memoir, is published by Faber. Mick McLaughlin was on sound. Sarah Binchy was the producer for Arts Tonight. From all of us, good night.